While you are busy enjoying your lunch, while you are busy having some times from 1300 hours, take time and listen to OTR News Bulletin.
On the Radio News Analysis, we go beyond the headlines. We don't just tell you what's happening. We ask why it's happening, how it affects ordinary Namibians, and what it means for the country's future. We examine the structures behind news, connect policy to people's lived realities, and bring in expert voices to make sense of where Namibia is heading.
You want to get into touch with global governance, global diplomacy, economic relations, trade, statistics, human and infrastructure development, and you want to see how policy planning and policy implementation is connected in Namibia. Make time and listen to OTR from 1300 hours to 1430 with Happy Juju.
Eagle FM, the eye.
A very good afternoon to you, Namibia, and a welcome to everyone joining us from near and far. Thank you for choosing Eagle FM, the home of insightful conversations and real national dialogue. I'm your host, Ndafa Happy Juju, and this is On The Reader News Analysis. It's the 25th of November, 2025. And now as we continue another new week, the country stands at another important crossroad where policies are being tested and communities are demanding answers. And the decisions made today will, of course, shape tomorrow's decisions, or better, tomorrow's. Now, on this program, we go beyond reporting the news. We examine the motives, unpack the impact, and question what it all means for ordinary Namibians, from our business districts to our local towns. In a time of fast change and louder narratives, we offer you something steady, informed analysis, credible voices, and space for critical reflection. Now, from 1300 hours to 1430, Monday through Friday, On The Reader connects you to issues, driving the national conversation with expert commentary, real life perspectives, and the kind of journalism that doesn't just inform but empowers. Now, today's edition will bring key developments into sharper focus, giving you the background, the facts, and the insight needed to understand the bigger picture. You can tune in via all Eagle FM frequencies, stream us live on the Eagle FM app, and stay connected through our WhatsApp channel for updates, polls, and exclusive content. So settle in, whether you're commuting, working, or listening from home, stay tuned. This is when Namibia pauses, reflects, and engages with its future.
Lipura nengeno wapumbwa eva tere ulikoni maondo tuto ingida ashike kapeno nweku dite opoye ekukulile. Oshafafana nongeshefa ili mehola mo iho etike kovano ile koshiwana. Onongeshefa ya pumbwa kukaraya kovano. Okupitira mo Eagle FM otuna evi toda njuka. Okukwetira oipindi konu konda doi inawa. Nune udo otukwetira o special ange tashake ngeshefa omarudi dayo loka. Okone ushendi fenawa nokumona oijemo ili nawa. Ninge fata fanona Monica ko Eagle FM. Onore tatu imwe bali heali nola natu heali bali no heali. Ile kumberewa nora hetatu natu bali o hetatu matatu o mafelane Eagle FM the eye.
Namibia is now counting down the final hours to the regional council and the local authority elections set for the 26th and the 27th of November, with the nation's attention firmly fixed on the Electoral Commission of Namibia, also known as ECN. Now, the elections, which have been declared public holidays, are expected to see thousands of Namibians across all regions making their way to polling stations to elect their local and regional representatives for the next term. Now, as anticipation builds, questions around preparedness, logistics, security, staffing, and transparency have come into sharp focus, especially in rural and hard-to-reach communities where access and infrastructure challenges remain a concern. Now, in this bulletin, we engage ECN spokesperson Devet Siluk to provide clarity on the Commission's state of readiness, the measures in place to ensure a smooth, credible, and accessible electoral process, and how ECN plans to address any last-minute challenges ahead of polling days. A very good afternoon to you, Siluka. It's a pleasure to have you with me in studio this afternoon.
Good afternoon, and good afternoon to the listeners.
Of course. So, Luca, of course, Namibians are gearing up for tomorrow being the 26th and the 27th. Just how is ECN prepared for tomorrow's elections?
Well, as we have earlier updated the nation, the Commission is very much ready for the conduct of this poll. The last stretch of our preparations was to conduct the deployment of our teams to various polling stations across the country.
Yeah.
And that exercise has commenced on Sunday, 23 November. It is continuing until today. However, we are glad to inform the nation that most of our teams that are deployed outside the towns have already arrived at their polling stations yesterday, or starting from Sunday. Mm-hmm. And the last teams that are being deployed in the cities or towns where we have our depots established, they have also left to their various polling stations this morning and this afternoon.
Mm-hmm.
So we can confirm that most of our teams across the country have been deployed and they have safely arrived at their various polling stations,
mm-hmm.
and they have already started with the setting up of the polling stations.
Nice.
In terms of our special voting, we had conducted special voting yesterday, and that started from 9 o'clock in the morning and ended at 7 o'clock in the evening across the country in all the 14 regions, the 120 constituency and 59 local authorities. We'll keep the nation updated on the outcome of the special voting as in the due course.
Mm-hmm. So, Luca, are there any preparations in case of perhaps ballot papers being finished, and just for emergency purposes, or what is ECN doing to try and mitigate such situations should they come on ground?
Yeah, I need to make it clear. I think there was a misconception of ballot papers getting finished last year, which was a wrong misperception,
mm-hmm.
let's say. Because we print enough ballot papers. We even print cottages. But you need to understand that for last year, voters were allowed to vote elsewhere. So you turn up at a voter registration point where your ballot paper has not been sent to. Because when we allocate ballot papers, we allocate ballot papers according to the number of people registered in that particular constituency.
Mm-hmm.
On that particular polling station. So what happened last year is one is registered in Windhoek West constituency. But because they are looking for areas with few voter turnout, they turn out to go into Windhoek Rural constituency. Now, your ballot paper has not been sent to Windhoek Rural constituency. It was sent to Windhoek West constituency.
Yeah.
But the law is flexible because you are allowed to vote elsewhere. So where you are going to vote, where they went to vote, they ended up finishing ballot papers there. But because the law allows for the movement of ballot papers from one polling station to the other, that was mitigated. And in this particular case for this year, you vote elsewhere, but within your constituency.
Mm-hmm.
So your ballot papers are sent to your constituents. Ballot papers are allocated according to the number of registered ballot paper in that constituency. So in the event that any of the polling station are running out of ballot papers, they will be able to borrow from the next polling station.
Okay.
Because we have printed enough ballot papers.
Clear. Just how should the nation themselves be prepared as they are going out to vote tomorrow? What are those things that you would say any person that is going to vote tomorrow should or shouldn't do?
In elections, you can only vote upon presenting your voter's card.
Mm-hmm.
Because we have to verify you against your voter's card. Of course, we have deployed the voter verification devices. That is our biometric identification system, where the voters will be identified both with your voter's card and your credential on the voter's register. Each constituency has its own voter's register. And when you turn up at the polling station, we will identify you whether or not you are from that constituency, because on your voter's card, there's the name of your constituency.
Yes.
But if for some reasons you went and you changed to your constituency, but you come with your old voter's card, because when you come with your old voter's card, it will still show your old constituency. But
correct.
On the system, we are going to show the current constituency, which is the last voter's card that you went to obtain. So we are going to verify you using your voter's card and ensure that indeed you are from that constituency and you can vote in that constituency.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So we encourage voters to carry their voter's cards when they are going to vote, and also ensure that they turn up at the right polling station or right constituency rather, where they have registered. Because if you have for some reason went and changed your residential address from one constituency to the other during the conduct of the supplementary registration of voters that was conducted between the period of 4 to 19 August this year, it means that that is the card that you have to go and present. And the credential on that card in terms of the constituency or local authority is where you have to go and vote.
Okay. Yes. Mm-hmm. So, Luka, are there any biggest challenges that ECN is anticipating, perhaps also from the citizens themselves? And how do you intend to address these ones?
Well, elections are complex in nature.
Yeah.
As a commission, we take that very seriously.
Mm-hmm.
We are monitoring this entire process from when it started to where we are now. And we'll closely continue monitoring it. In case of any eventualities, the commission is ready to adjust wherever it is possible that we ensure the smooth process of this whole entire election.
Mm-hmm. What's on the table for ECN right after this regional council elections?
Immediately after the conduct of this election, the commission will then start with the production of its post-election assessment report.
Yeah.
Which is a requirement by law, and that is the last phase of the electoral cycle, which is the post-electoral cycle, to assess and review what worked and what didn't work. And this report must be submitted to National Assembly for then where it will then be tabled, and then after that adopted, and after it's been adopted, then it will become a public document. And thereafter, we begin with the planning for the 2029 Presidential National Assembly election.
Okay. Now Namibia usually doesn't record so much violence around elections, but what's your message to the public out there, also just to stay away from violence in terms of this election?
Of course, we are known as a very peaceful nation, and in this country there are laws and structures that ensure that we are kept safe and secure, both us as human beings and our properties. And I just want to encourage and urge every peace-loving Namibian to abide by the rule of law and to ensure peace and, that we, encourage peace across all our dealings as we move forward to the conduct of these elections.
Mm-hmm. Siluka, thank you so much for making time for us right here on the Rural News Analysis. We do appreciate your time.
You are most welcome. Thank you.
Okay. Bye. Mm-hmm. And there you had it from ECN's spokesperson, David Siluka, who was just providing clarity on the Commission's state of readiness, the measures in place to ensure a smooth, credible and accessible electoral process, and how ECN plans to address any last-minute challenges ahead of polling days. Now stay tuned as we bring you other news that we are going to analyze. Let's take a trip to the marketplace for now. Also, remember our studio line is open should you be interested in asking questions right here on 083-288-401. I'll see you after the commercial break.
Eagle FM lets you express your constitutional rights of freedom of expression without fear of favor.
This is actually, to put it mildly, an economic scandal.
Fraud.
Not fraud, it's a scandal. Why do you give a tender to somebody who does not have capacity to build? Why should you do that? You're the person that does not have the capacity to build.
Eagle FM lets you talk.
That's why I'm always telling people in Parliament, let me not take up my Katatura manners.
Right.
Because I grew up in Katatura.
Uh-huh.
And I will not hesitate to tell you off if it is needed to
be part of the debate by setting the agenda.
My response in terms of Rwanda at 6% is that we had been there before. We've had 6% growth before.
Mm.
It's not something that Namibia has not achieved in the past.
Mm.
And it's not something that Namibia will not be able to achieve in the future.
Eagle FM, the eye.
Goeie nuus, Imba het nou nog beter geword. Ons het splinter nuwe funksies bygevoeg om jou
ervaring. Welcome back. The long-awaited upgrade of the 20.45-kilometer DR3469 Bevo-Erango Road in the Kavango West region was officially launched on Monday by the Minister of Works and Transport, Veiko Nekundi. Now, the project is expected to bring relief to the five regions, Siyeketera, Senseni, Mutungarika, Kamuti, and Erago, which for years have relied on an impassable sandy road that often cut the communities off, especially during the rainy season. Nekundi said the old road has crippled movement, limiting access to clinics, schools, and markets. He noted that the upgraded road, strengthened with soil stabilizers, would provide reliable all-season access for residents. The minister further announced that the project is expected to create about 80 job opportunities for the community. He issued a stance warning to contractors to uphold the labor standards, stressing fair wages, the provision of personal protective equipment, the registration of workers with the Social Security Commission, and strict adherence to safety regulations. And I quote, "We'll build roads, but not on the backs of exploited workers," Nekundi said. Now, according to the minister, the road upgrade will ensure that expectant mothers and patients can reach Erago Clinic safely, make travel easier for school children, and improve the transportation of agricultural produce, giving a much-needed boost for the local community. Government has also committed funding toward the improvement of other key roads in the region, including the Kurunkuru-Nepara Clinic Road and the Diona Dinjara Njara Road and the Divundu Muhembo Border Post Road. Meanwhile, Roads Authority. But for now, let's take a listen to Minister of Works and Transport, Veiko Nekundi.
All technical details are addressed without further ado, and that no man-made technical delays will be permitted. You must ensure that this road is constructed within the prescribed quality and the standards. There should be no compromise in that regard. In the same vein, I must make it very much categorically clear, Honorable Governor, and I am cognizant that in 2 days' time there will be elections. I'm sure those who will be elected are those that are responsible, accountable, and trustworthy by the communities. Just vote correct. You understand what I mean, vote correct. It is bad while struggling with a sandy and marked road. In this regard, local and regional economic activities will be enhanced with employment opportunities that will be created. Our state-owned enterprise, the Road Authority, has been tasked with the responsibility for the overall management and successful implementation of this important road, your road. Another government entity, RCC, the Road Contractor Company, shall commence with the actual construction of the road that ensure immediate improvement and execution of the project within an agreed time frame of 12 months, no extension. This project must be completed within a time as agreed, within the budget as agreed and accordingly allocated. We shall not entertain any cost escalations as a result of poor workmanship or man-made delays in the execution of this very important project. We must appreciate that the people of these two constituencies have been waiting for this road for not less than 35 years. Therefore, any delay is like sending them to premature death. Therefore, it must not be tolerated. Getting back then, while struggling with a sandy and mud road. In this regard, local and regional economic activities will be enhanced with employment opportunities that will be created. Our state-owned enterprise, the Road Authority, has been tasked with the responsibility for the overall management and successful implementation of this important road, your road. Another government entity, RCC, the Road Contractor Company, shall commence with the actual construction of the road that ensure immediate improvement and execution of the project within an agreed time frame of 12 months, no extension. This project must be completed within a time as agreed, within the budget as agreed, and accordingly allocated. We shall not entertain any cost escalations as a result of poor workmanship or man-made delays in the execution of this very important project. We must appreciate that the people of these two constituencies have been waiting for this road for not less than 35 years. Therefore, any delay is like sending them to premature death. Therefore, it must not be tolerated. Others, the government, your government, stand ready to respond to your cry as we are here today. Hence, the upgrading of this very important road to a standard of soil stabilizers. The 20.45 kilometers of a district road 3469 Mbeyo Erago to Matende Road project will benefit many communities, multiple villages. In that regard, one must appreciate, and I see no reason that you do not appreciate what your government have done for you and continue to do for you. My hope and wish is that the improvement of this infrastructure will ensure our communities have accessibility to all government facilities and services unhindered due to any difficulties as a result of road challenges. I said expecting mothers should now, after the completion of this project, be able, with comfort, be able to reach medical assistance without any challenges, in particular those wishing to reach the Erago clinic. School children should be able to have access to their school facilities, teachers alike. Farmers should be able to ensure their produce reach the markets of their choice in the shortest possible time.
Roads Authority Regional Engineering Manager Kennedy Chingumira has called for immediate funding in order to upgrade gravel roads in the Kabango West region. He warned that deteriorating infrastructure continues to isolate rural communities and restrict access to essential services. Chimungira made the remarks at the groundbreaking ceremony of the Mbeo Erangho Road, where he revealed that Namibia's road network currently stands at approximately 49,000 kilometers, with about 90% made up of gravel roads. He said maintaining these roads has become increasingly difficult due to ongoing budget constraints, and he cautioned that poor road conditions are impacting access to education, healthcare, and economic activities, particularly in remote areas where residents depend on sandy and unstable tracks. Chingumira urged government and development partners to prioritize funding for road upgrades, especially in rural regions. He identified key routes that require urgent attention, including the Charlie Cut Line, the Nakute Karukwisa Road, as well as roads linking Diona, Dinjaranjara, Mpungu, and Nkaute. Now, in addition, Chingumira appealed to motorists to play their part in protecting road infrastructure by avoiding vehicle overloading, obeying speed limits, and refraining from vandalizing road signage. He stressed that safeguarding road infrastructure is a shared responsibility between communities and authorities. Let's now take a listen to him. That is Roads Authority Rundu Regional Engineering Manager Kennedy Chingumira.
Remains committed to ensuring our road network is built to the highest standards. We are also committed to ensuring that our road infrastructure is regularly maintained to facilitate trade and the movement of goods and people throughout Namibia and beyond. We believe that the transformation process must go in the most marginalized communities to ensure that they too are beneficiaries of and activists for change. Ladies and gentlemen, however, Namibia is a network of approximately 49,000 kilometers, of which 90% are gravel roads, meaning almost out of the 49,000, only tarred roads are around 8,000 kilometers, which means there is a lot of work which is needed to be done. So due to budgetary constraints, adequately maintaining the gravel network has become a very serious challenge. It is common knowledge that roads are not in good condition. Roads which are not in good condition hamper the connection and linkages of communities to essential services such as social, education, health, and commercial. Hence, we need financial support from our government and other financiers to continue serving the nation so the economy can grow and benefit all. Increasing the investment and funding for road projects is fundamental to eradicating poverty, as it will drive economic activities that depend on road infrastructure. As road users, you can do your part to prevent the network from deteriorating due to irresponsible road usage. Things like road signs on the road, let's respect them, let's not vandalize them, let's not ride on them. Once a road is completed, please avoid overloading, speeding, and the same thing I expressed again, vandalizing road signs. We must continue to value our roads as a national asset and enter tickets to a better livelihood for all of us. Director of Ceremony, in conclusion, I would like to express our sincere gratitude to our Honorable Minister Bekole Kumbi for his relentless support.
Now, good road infrastructure is one of the most critical foundations for national development, particularly in a vast and sparsely populated country like Namibia. Good roads are essential for connecting people to services, boosting economic activity, and ensuring that no community remains isolated. Now, as Roads Authority Regional Engineer Manager Kennedy Chingumira recently highlighted, the state of Namibia's gravel-dominated road network urgently requires investment and attention. For many Namibians, especially those living in remote regions such as Kabango West, roads serve the primary link to education, healthcare markets, and government services. When roads are poorly maintained or become impassable, that is, difficult to work on or difficult to drive on. Communities are cut off, making it difficult for children to reach schools, patients to access clinics, and farmers to transport their produce. Now, also bear in mind that Kavango is identified as Namibia's food basket. So when we do actually, when the green schemes, for instance, are now producing enough or in abundance in order to sustain the majority of Namibians, how difficult it will be for those goods to actually get to Windhoek or to get here on time and to get to other towns as well, because the road is not so good. Hence why road infrastructure, regardless of whether it's in rural areas or in urban areas, is of utmost importance, and it's a major contribution to the economy of any country. In regions where tracks are sandy, unstable, or heavily eroded, the impact is even more severe. Poor road conditions can increase travel times, infiltrate transport costs, and discourage essential service providers from reaching rural populations. Roads and economic development contribute highly. So Namibia's economy depends on efficient transport networks to support agriculture, tourism, mining, and trade. Good roads, therefore, reduce lower transportation costs for businesses and consumers. They improve access to markets, particularly for small-scale farmers. They support tourism, as one of Namibia's key revenue areas is the tourism sector. They also facilitate cross-border trade and regional integration. And at the end of the day, they attract investment by ensuring reliable movement of goods and services. Let's go back to supporting tourism. Now, as we know, tourism is one of the sectors that contribute to our gross domestic product. Now, tourists would not want to continue coming to a country with very bad road infrastructure. In other words, it would discourage them from coming if our roads are not upgraded, they're not on the best, on par with what is out there in the world, or at least average, at least average. Now, I have heard that other roads in other countries can be terrible, so much that it takes a person so many hours to travel a distance that would have required perhaps, maybe it can take 24 hours on a distance that would have required only 8 hours, all because the road infrastructure is very bad. Now, without functional road infrastructures, economic activities slow down, and this is true for any given country. Investment opportunities do diminish, and local businesses struggle to expand. Now, Chingura revealed that Namibia's national road network stretches roughly 49,000 kilometers, with about 90% consisting of gravel roads. Now, while Namibia is often praised for having one of the best roads networks in Africa, maintaining such an extensive gravel network remains a major challenge. Budget constraints have limited the roads authority's ability to upgrade or regularly maintain many rural roads. As a result, several key routes such as the Charlie Cut Line, the Nakute, Karukisa, and the roads linking Diona and others, Mpungo and Kaute, have deteriorated and now require urgent rehabilitation. Now, if gravel roads deteriorate, the consequences are far-reaching, one of them being ambulances struggle to reach patients in emergencies. Teachers and nurses face difficulties commuting, which worsens staffing in rural areas. And at the end of the day, it also discourages teachers from wanting to work in those schools. At the end of the day, many teachers will rather prefer for cross transfer to other areas which are more easily accessible, because nobody wants to be fixing their car every now and then because of a bad road. Farmers also experience increased transport losses and reduced income as well, making loss of business. Now, youth and learners are disadvantaged due to lack of reliable access to schools. In essence, poor roads reinforce inequality by making it harder for rural Namibians to access opportunities available elsewhere. Now, Namibia stands at a critical point where the condition of its gravel-dominated road network can either accelerate or hinder the nation's development. Investing in good road upgrades, particularly in rural regions, is essential for improving service delivery, also boosting economic growth and ensuring that no community remains left behind. And I highlight, no community is left behind. I read, and I think it was a social media post just this very week, that with all the roads that have been constructed all throughout this year or even the year before, none of them were earmarked for the southern area, southern part of Namibia. If that is true, then there needs to be a balance as to where and how, which rural area or which regions or which, whether north, west or south, there has to be a balance, because a well-maintained road network is not just convenience. It is a national asset and a pathway to inclusive development. Now, of course, for now, we pause right here and take a trip to the marketplace. Remember, you can also partake in the news analysis by dialing in on studio on 083-288-401. For now, I'll see you after the commercial break.
Eagle FM lets you express your constitutional rights of freedom of expression without fear of failure.
This is actually, to put it mildly, an economic scandal.
Fraud.
Not a fraud, it's a scandal.
Scandal.
Why do you give a tender to somebody who does not have capacity to build? Why should you do that? You know a person that doesn't have the capacity to build.
Eagle FM lets you talk.
That's why I'm always telling people in Parliament, let me not take up my Katatura manners.
Right.
Because I grew up in Katatura. And I will not hesitate to tell you off if it is needed to
be part of the debate by setting the agenda.
My response in terms of Rwanda at 6% is that we had been there before. We've had 6% growth before. It's not something that Namibia has not achieved in the past, and it's not something that Namibia will not be able to achieve in the future.
Eagle FM, the eye.
Ipura nenge no wapumbwa eva tere ulikoni maundu tuto ingida ashike kapeno nweku tite opoye ekukulile. Oshafafa na nongeshefa ili mehola mo ihewe tike kovano ile koshiwana. Onongeshefa ya pumbwa kukaraya kovano. Okupitira mo Eagle FM otuna evi toda njuka. Okupitira oipindi konu konda doi inawa. Nune udo otukwetira o special ange tashake ngeshefa omarudi dayo loka. Opone ushendi fenawa nukumona oijamo ili nawa. Ninge kwa tafanona Monica ko Eagle FM. Onore zatu imwe bali heali nola natu heali bali no heali. Ile kumberewa, nora hetatu natu, bali o hetatu batatu, o mafelane, Eagle FM, the eye.
Eagle FM lets you express your constitutional rights of freedom of expression without fear of failure.
This is actually, to put it mildly, an economic scandal.
Fraud.
Not a fraud, it's a scandal.
Scandal.
Why do you give a tender to somebody who does not have capacity to build? Why should you do that? You know a person that doesn't have the capacity to build.
Eagle FM lets you talk.
That's why I'm always telling people in Parliament, let me not take up my Katatura manners.
Right.
Because I grew up in Katatura. And I will not hesitate to tell you off if it is needed to
be part of the debate by setting the agenda.
My response in terms of Rwanda at 6% is that we had been there before. We've had 6% growth before. It's not something that Namibia has not achieved in the past, and it's not something that Namibia will not be able to achieve in the future.
Eagle FM, the eye.
Ipura nenge no wapumbwa eva tere ulikoni maundu tuto ingida ashike kapeno nweku tite opoye ekukulile. Oshafafa na nongeshefa ili mehola mo ihewe tike kovano ile koshiwana. Onongeshefa ya pumbwa kukaraya kovano. Okupitira mo Eagle FM otuna evi toda njuka. Okupitira oipindi konu konda doi inawa. Nune udo otukwetira o special ange tashake ngeshefa omarudi dayo loka. Opone ushendi fenawa nukumona oijamo ili nawa. Ninge kwa tafanona Monica ko Eagle FM. Onore zatu imwe bali heali nola natu heali bali no heali. Ile kumberewa nora hetatu natu bali o hetatu batatu o mafelane Eagle FM the eye.
Welcome back. Now it's at this point that we tell you what's happening in terms of economic indicators as well as trading economics. Now we always start off by comparing the Namibian dollar to the US dollar. So one US dollar today is equals to 17.35 Namibian dollars. And one euro is equals to 19.98 Namibian dollars. One Chinese yuan is equals to 2 Namibian dollars and 44 cents. 1 Swiss franc is equals to 21 Namibian dollars and 41 cents. 1 pound sterling is equals to 22 Namibian dollars and 76 cents. 1 Botswana pula is equals to 1 Namibian dollar and 29 cents. 1 Ugandan shilling on the other end is equals to 0.0048 Namibian dollars. And that's what we had for you today in terms of currencies. Let's now move over to trading economics. Cotton futures rose slightly to around 61.8 cents per pound, a near 1 week high as expectations of a potential Federal Reserve rate cut bolstered demand prospects. Now, in the meantime, the latest U.S. weekly sales report published on November 21 suggested increasing demand. U.S. upland cotton export sales surged to 199,000 running bales for the week ending October the 2nd, more than doubling the previous figure and exceeded the four-week average. Retail sales in Poland rose by 5.4% year-on-year in October 2025, slowing from a 6.4% gain in September, but exceeding market expectations of a 3.7% advance. Now sales growth moderated for motor vehicles, motorcycles, and parts at 15.0% versus 15.6% in September. Pharmaceuticals, cosmetics, and orthopedic equipment at 4.4% versus 5.6%. And food, beverages, and tobacco products at 0.2% versus 0.6%. Now, conversely, stronger growth was observed in solid, liquid, and gaseous fuels at 7.1% versus 4.7%. Other goods at 3.3% versus 2.4%. Furniture, radios, TVs, and household appliances at 16.1% versus 13.9%. Tourist arrivals in Slovenia rose by 8.8% year-on-year to 0.51 million in October 2025, easing from an 11.7% increase in the previous month. Now, the number of foreign arrivals increased by 10.6% to 374,641, while domestic arrivals rose by 4.4% to 138,800. Now, most foreign visitors came from Germany, Australia, Italy, Hungary, and Croatia. Meanwhile, overnight stays grew by 9.7% to 1.3 million, led by stays in the health spa resorts. Imports from Hong Kong surged 18.3% year-on-year to 501.7 billion dollars in October 2025, marking the fastest pace in 5 months and accelerating from a 13.6% gain in September. The gains were led by electrical machinery, apparatus and appliances, and electrical parts, telecommunications and sound recording and reproducing apparatus, and office machines and automatic data processing machines at 10.2%. Now, by contrast, imports fell in miscellaneous manufactured articles at minus 4.5% and professional scientific and controlling instruments at minus 1.0%. Now, that's all I had for you today in terms of economic indicators and trading economics. Let's pause right here, take a trip to the marketplace. We'll be back shortly with news beyond the borders.
Eagle FM lets you express your constitutional rights of freedom of expression without fear of favor.
This is actually, to put it mildly, an economic scandal.
Fraud.
Not fraud, it's a scandal.
Scandal.
Why do you give a tender to somebody who does not have capacity to build? Why should you do that? You're the person who doesn't have the capacity to build.
Eagle FM lets you talk.
That's why I'm always telling people in parliament, let me not take up my Katatura manners.
Right.
Because I grew up in Katatura.
Uh-huh.
And I will not hesitate to tell you off if it is needed to
be part of the debate by setting the agenda.
My response in terms of Rwanda at 6% is that we had been there before. We've had 6% growth before.
Mm.
It's not something that Namibia has not achieved in the past,
mm.
and it's not something that Namibia will not be able to achieve in the future.
Eagle FM.
Ipurane ngeno wapumbwa Eva tere urikoni maondo duto ingida ashike kapeno nweko dite opoewe ekukulile oshafafa na nongeshe faili mehola mo ihewe kike kovano ile koshiwani ono ngeshefa ya pumbwa kukaraya kovano Okupitira mo Eagle FM otuna evi tota njuka okukwetira oipindi konu konda baby nawa nune udo otukwetira o special ange tashake ngejefa omarudi dayo loka okone ushendife nawa nukumona oijamoiri nawa ninge kwata fanona Monica ko Eagle FM onora etatu imwe bali heali nola natu heali bali no heali ile kongerewa nora etatu natu bali o etatu watatu o mafelane Eagle FM the eye.
And now for news beyond the borders. Let's start off in South Africa, KwaZulu-Natal to be specific, on KwaZulu-Natal's floods, where mop-up operations are underway in Usmwathi following heavy rainfall.
Let's bring you this headline story now. The search continues for two people who were swept away in flash floods in Umshwati. That's near Pietermaritzburg in KwaZulu-Natal. It comes after heavy rain battered the area, leaving houses and roads severely damaged. Rescue teams have found the body of a woman who's believed to be in her 40s. Yesterday, the heavy rain left hundreds of people homeless. Yesterday, families were trying to salvage some of their belongings that were scattered along the riverbank. Authorities say temporary shelter is now being provided to the affected families. Disaster management teams are still on high alert, with more rains expected. Speaking of that, storms are also expected to continue in parts of Gauteng, bringing cooler temperatures. The South African Weather Service is warning that the current weather pattern of the province suggests a high risk of severe thunderstorms. Senior forecaster Samgelisiwe Twala says parts of the province remain at risk of damaging thunderstorms. The Weather Service says a yellow level 4 warning for severe storms and excessive lightning is expected over the high veld of Mpumalanga and the northern parts of Gauteng. It says the warning is in place for the southern parts of Gauteng as well, the eastern parts of the Free State, southwestern parts of Limpopo, and places over the high veld in the southern escarpment of Mpumalanga. Let's get you a sense of how things are looking like in KwaZulu-Natal. Take you back to the area called New Hanover. That's where our reporter Nontlagani Pamagwaza is standing by as that search and recovery effort continues. She joins us now live. Nontlagani, yesterday we understood, of course, that two people were still unaccounted for. In fact, they were reported missing. What are you able to tell us about the work that's been done so far to try and find them?
Good morning, Ayanda, and to the viewers at home. So far, all we know is that the search and rescue team is gathered at the fire station. They are there meeting up just to plan their rescue routes or their search routes for today. Of course, the two people have not been found. Community members have also been assisting since yesterday just to search for the three missing people. The one lady was found by community members before search and rescue teams carried out the recovery process. However, disaster management teams are on the ground. They are here assessing the situation. As you can see behind me, the devastation that the floods of the day before caused in this area. Houses were lining this riverbank, and most of them were washed away. The house that you see in front of you, or rather the rental cottages that you see in front of you, that's where the three people who went missing when the floods hit were renting out their places. Of course, when we were speaking to community members, they did say that the three were just renting out. They worked in the area but were not living or were not part of the Umshwati community, but they came from different parts of the province. Others came from the Eastern Cape. When the floods hit, the bridge that you see behind me, that's what they are trying to clear out today. The excavator and TLBs have been removing logs that were blocking the bridge behind us. That caused the water to overflow and come on top of the bridge. That's why the flooding occurred, because there was no way for the water to go through or pass through the bridge. As you can see, that's the amount of sand, rubble, and as well as logs that were removed from this particular bridge this morning. And parts of the bridge have been sectioned out because it collapsed when the water, the force of the water pushed the barrier or the foundation of the bridge. However, the Transport Department did say that they were working on fixing the bridge. For now, it is one car at a time. It's no longer a two-way road because of the steadiness and as well as it's still muddy in some sections. As you can see behind me as well, most of the houses are lining this area were mud houses. That's why some of them were washed away. But of course, the same mud houses are the mud houses that were offered as rental homes for some of the people who are living here. We heard from authorities yesterday that most of the people were not from South Africa, but renting out places in this area, and they were from undocumented foreigners. However, we are expecting that COGTA MEC, Mr. Reverend Thulasizwe Buthelezi, will be making his way here just to assess and offer relief for the 100 families that have been displaced by the floods on Sunday evening. Back to you in studio, Ayanda.
Sure. What a devastating set of circumstances. Nonhlakanipho Magwaza live to us there from the Umshwati local municipality. For now, thanks very much indeed.
South Africa hosted a successful G20 Leaders Summit. Let's take a listen.
G20 presidency. The Sherpa of South Africa's G20 presidency and Director General of the Department of International Relations and Cooperation, Zain Dango, says both South Africa and the United States want the handover of the G20 presidency to be a low-key affair. It will probably be done by a senior official from DERCO to the U.S. diplomatic representative at the department's offices in Pretoria on Tuesday. South Africa had made it clear on Saturday that the U.S. could not send its embassy charge d'affaires to receive the presidency gavel from President Cyril Ramaphosa at the summit. Meanwhile, the G20 summit ended with a joint declaration committing to multilateral cooperation despite objections from the U.S., which boycotted the two-day summit. Let's unpack this now with international relations analyst Professor Chris Isike, and we're also joined by Dr. Charles Sinkala. Dr. Isike, I'm going to start the conversation with you. Thank you so much for your time. Really do appreciate it. It was quite a success. Most of the U.S. allies in the G7 nations, like France, Canada, the U.K., Japan, had all thrown their weight behind South Africa and strongly stand firm on the declaration and the outcome there. But is the declaration and its outcome likely to be, let's call it, informally ratified to all G20 member states under a U.S. presidency?
Well, look, it's like a win for South Africa. It was well organized and well implemented. There were a lot of significant policy and symbolic wins just by hosting this alone, apart from the soft power value, the delivery on debt, minerals, infrastructure, and climate agreements that were, reached are significant. But like you highlighted, the real test is in the delivery. The question of whether Pretoria can convert these G20 frameworks into actual finance and sustainable outcomes, especially given its current the United States. I think that one of the quick lessons that even the United States itself is learning from all of this is that, the rest of the world will be prepared to move away from the United States does not come to the party. And I think that that's something that can be leveraged by the Global South and their relationship with the rest of the Global North in this case.
Let's talk about what Donald Trump has said previously about the themes and, of course, consequently and subsequently some of what would come out in the declaration being under the themes of solidarity, inclusivity, and sustainability to be politics that are anti-American and that he doesn't espouse such a politics. We're going to be talking about the establishment of an Africa engagement framework, the support of the African Continental Free Trade Agreement, debt restructuring for the Global South. Donald Trump would consider all of these sorts of interventions as being, so to speak, DEI sort of politics that fall under those themes. Is this something he is likely to want to undo? And to the extent that he does, how much power would the UK, being at the top end of that troika, be to sort of hold together the outcomes of the 2025 declaration?
Well, like you said, he considers those things as the I, but they are not exactly anti-American. This is his preference. And usually a president's idiosyncrasies does have an impact on the foreign policy of the country. In this case, we see in very clearly in America. But one of the things I may want to point out in this regard in terms of the power that he has is the fact that he's increasingly becoming a lame duck president now in the U.S. He's been defied by even members of his own party. He's not getting the kind of wins and leverage that he thought he had. So that can be a factor as well. The United Kingdom being the next host after the U.S., important party to the Troika, will not exactly play to America's tune on all of these issues because the UK believes firmly in some of these values of solidarity, equality, you know, and multilateralism. And I'm sure that they will be able to push the ones that they can push forward aside of what South Africa can do in terms of some of the agreements that have been reached in your country. It would have been really good if South Africa, on behalf of Africa, was able to tie some of these agreements to critical minerals. That would have been able to give us a hand, you know, to force through some of these agreements that the declaration showed.
Let's speak about that, because that declaration outcome on critical minerals for the establishment of a G20 critical minerals framework is quite a significant step, especially given that the question of critical minerals is less a scientific question and more a political question, because each country around the world has a different sense of what critical minerals are to them based on their deposits availability, market demands, as well as their ability to extract, to prospect and extract and develop those minerals. And so to have a collective framework, I think, puts the world on a central theme around how to pursue and manage critical minerals. The U.S. Had imposed tariffs on South Africa, with the exception of certain precious metal groups, minerals, which, of course, the U.S. deeply wants. And, of course, the U.S. would want to be happy about an attempt to establish a G20 critical minerals framework. Do you see Trump being proactive in steering that forward?
Well, he could, because he's interested in critical minerals. And apart from this critical minerals framework of the G20, which supports, countries that are rich in these minerals, many of which are in Africa, you know, to move up the value chain. And the South African president was very particular about, you know, beneficiation and adding local value. This is very important for the continent. But one of the things that I think would help us even more, and I'm talking Africa now, would be having a common African position on critical minerals, specifically with the United States, an Africa-US strategy, if you like, on critical minerals. And that's one of the things that my center is currently engaged in research in doing, so that we can have that common position that can tie to this G20 critical minerals framework. And then in that kind of situation, it would be very difficult for anyone, including the President of the United States, to simply deviate. But given his interest in minerals, I think he would want to play ball if we can negotiate as a group and from a position of strength.
But that would mean that the African continent would themselves need to reach consensus. Minister Mantashe hosts his counterparts across the continent every year at a gathering in Cape Town every February. Yet despite that, there isn't a single uniform framework across the continent around what critical minerals are.
And that's really sad. And I think that Africa needs to understand that as individual countries, we'll simply be cherry-picked by superpowers, not just the United States. It's China, it's Russia, and even middle powers that are interested in these minerals. We need to develop a common African position on them. We've been very good at developing a common African position on a number of issues which we have managed to follow through, right? So I think that this, the next thing we should be doing, apart from the one we've done now on digitalization and AI, is the critical minerals. Otherwise, we will simply be knocked one against the other. like our previous minerals, and the West will get it and dictate the price, and we'll just become marginal players as always.
Yeah, taking place right now in Luanda is the AU-EU summit, which of course takes place with all of the declaration points being top of mind from the G20. How much is that momentum important for the engagement taking place in Luanda right now to build the sort of drive, catalytic force that we need for the implementation of some of the resolutions?
Well, if we go there as a group, as a continent, even if represented by major critical mineral countries in the continent, we would be able to achieve something significant. And I think that what Europe is doing is taking advantage of the absence of the United States, especially from the G20, and the kind of relationship that is beginning to develop between Europe and Africa. It's a momentum that we should ride on, but it will be meaningless if we go there each as a foreign policy, having a specific foreign policy interest that doesn't align to the bigger picture of having a common position. And I think that's what we must do, and play even everyone that is interested like a beautiful bride to get the best deal from on offer from any of the parties that are interested, and that should also include the United States. And thankfully, critical minerals is a language that Mr. Trump understands.
Yeah, we're going to have to leave it there. Thank you so much for your time, Chris. Really do appreciate it. Dr. Chris Isike, who is at the Africa Center for the Studies on the United States of America at the University of Pretoria.
Meanwhile, Zambia has launched the National Child Protection Digital Strategy.
In a bid to safeguard the future of Zambia's children, the Ministry of Technology and Science, in collaboration with key stakeholders, has launched the National Child Online Protection Strategy 2025-2029. The strategy aims to create a safe, inclusive, and empowering digital environment for children and young people in Zambia, protecting them from online sexual abuse, exploitation, harmful content, and cyberbullying. Permanent Secretary in the Ministry of Technology and Science, Brilliant Habenzu, was the guest of honor at the launch.
Let it be a reminder that our goal is not only to protect children from online harm, but also to enable them to thrive safely, confidently, and creatively in the digital world. Our national target is to reduce the reported cases of online child abuse by at least 50% by the year 2029. Through prevention, education, and stronger enforcement.
For Zicta, the strategy is a collaborative commitment to make the internet a place of learning, creativity, and growth for children, not fear or harm.
Protecting children online is not the responsibility of one institution alone. It is a shared mission that requires unity, awareness, and continued commitment from all of us. Together, let us build a digital Zambia that is safe, responsible.
UNICEF Zambia representative Dr. Saji Faroku Abdullah emphasized that protecting children online is a moral, social, and developmental necessity.
Online safety needs to be recognized as national health priority. We need investment in the prevention of children, young people, and parents and their community. Investing in prevention is key. This strategy cannot be implemented by one entity. It needs really collaboration to allocate resources to implement this strategy with its action plan, which is costed to be $1.8 million.
The launch of the National Child Online Protection Strategy 2025-2029 marks a critical step towards transforming commitments into actionable measures that protect children from online harm. Nyam Ben Alishavo, ZMBC News, Lusaka.
Also in Zambia, the World Bank has launched $170 million agribusiness and trade project phase 2 in Zambia.
A round of applause, please, as the minister.
It is the beginning of the second phase of the Zambia Agribusiness and Trade Project, ZATP. The project has come courtesy of the Zambian government through the Ministry of Commerce with the support of the World Bank. Many farmers across the 10 provinces are expected to benefit from the project, and it comes with technical and financial support, as well as increasing market access for farming products.
This high order financing, ladies and gentlemen, that came through SACHET was not only given by the World Bank to Zambia alone, it was given to many other African countries. We are proud that with you and holding this World Bank, Zambia performed better than any other country in Africa. And through that, we now attracted $170 million. Ladies and gentlemen, it's something worth giving a pat on.
I urge cooperatives, business firms in the Cobra Belt to seize this opportunity by leveraging the support provided under that tool.
The World Bank Group is happy to support the Zambian government in the agriculture sector.
In the launch of SACHET 2, which is a government program supported by the World Bank, reflects our shared values and our commitment to expanding market access, improving financing, and fostering sustainable growth in agribusiness.
We are targeting a very high number of beneficiaries, over 133,000, over 12,550 jobs.
Filoshisho olodali kutungupo. Oma wa o tomono okujako NHP. Genge wa longifaye longifo lilipedulo wa wo uhaku. Olo halipiti kwa efiku nefiku. Mefiloshi shelo uhaku oe. Owa washi mali wa oshosha kupako. Washika wedgelwa komto alando lako. Kashi koma punglo ena shano unjola welewe. Otodulo okulongifa oma wa oe. Wa hupuko opo unamiti toshiningi momikalo dihapungashi. Okufuti lapo oi mali wa ishona. Oyo hodulo okupolwa. Ulifutila ove mwene, omayakulo olu hapu, hakala ina kwa telwa, mowawe kwa folo elu unamiti. Ile, oto julu no kuli, okupitifapo ee mwedi donumba, tokala inofuta ea kulolo elu unamiti. Kwa uyalele uhapu, talela po nhp.com.na. Ema ngono malandola fwana ododi na okulandulwa. NHP, rooted in care for you.
Your health, your life, your peace of mind. NHP, we're about you.
In the launch of SACHET 2, which is a government program supported by the World Bank, reflects our shared values and our commitment to expanding market access, improving financing, and fostering sustainable growth in agribusiness.
We are targeting a very high number of beneficiaries, over 133,000. Over 12,550 jobs will be created through the project.
The project's manager is excited about the new venture.
We would also like to ensure that all the businesses that we support become resilient and sustainable. And in trying to do that, we have put in measures to ensure that there's a lot of technical support that will go to the farmers and the SMEs.
The Commerce and Cooperative Ministers later took a tour of the beneficiaries of the first phase of this project.
We are very ready for SACHET 2. It comes at a time when we are ready to enter new markets. We are ready to scale up.
Tevere Tseka, ZNBC News, Ndola.
Experts discuss how boosting agriculture serves as a poverty reduction pathway.
He is emerging. Now, boosting agricultural productivity is emerging as Africa's most powerful pathway to reducing poverty and also improving food security. Now, with growing support from partners such as China, strategic investments are helping to raise farm incomes. They're also helping to lower food prices and fuel broader economic development. Well, Dr. Michael Sampson from the Economic Policy Research Institute spoke to CGTN's Gasturi Manikam on how stronger collaboration can accelerate these positive outcomes.
This is a key element for food security, which is another global concern. China and South Africa have been collaborating on food resilience over the years. How would you like both sides to strengthen food systems resilience to reduce poverty, especially in Africa?
So the great opportunity in Africa is to raise productivity in agriculture. It's an opportunity for countries that have capital to invest to take advantage of the really positive investment opportunities in Africa, not just in terms of profitability, but in terms of social impact. Raising agricultural productivity raises incomes for farmers, it lowers the price of food, and it creates opportunities for rural diversification. And so these opportunities will reduce hunger, will reduce poverty, will improve food security, but can also sustain a diversified rural development agenda that not only tackles poverty, because if you talk to African leaders, their focus is not just on reducing poverty, it's ensuring a shared prosperity.
Also, experts analyze China's role in Africa's efforts on climate change, green energy, and food security.
2025 G20 summit in Johannesburg has ended with a call to action to address global challenges and strengthen multilateralism. South African President Cyril Ramaphosa thanked G20 leaders for adopting a declaration which seeks to address a range of global issues from peace and security, hunger and climate change, to debt restructuring. In his speech during the summit, Chinese Premier Li Qiang called for the G20 to strive for broader global cooperation to jointly cope with challenges and promote development. He made three appeals to promote international cooperation amid global challenges, such as climate change, energy shortages, and food crises. We earlier spoke to Professor David Monnier, director of the Center for Africa-China Studies at the University of Johannesburg and co-director of the Confucius Institute in South Africa via Zoom. He analyzed Premier Li Qiang's focus on climate change, green energy, and food security. Let's listen in.
These are areas that requires more cooperation, and I think China is playing a critical role in working with the African continent in dealing with those. On food security, I think there has been, through the Forum on China-Africa Cooperation, a lot of agreement and a lot of upskilling of Africans in terms of technology, in dealing with the issue of improving yields in agriculture. On climate change, similarly, China is doing a wonderful job in terms of technology that is improving energy on the African continent. Affordable solar panels, energy, building of energy infrastructure on the African continent. This is key. I think more need to be done to reach a consensus at a global level. And continuing doing so, I think it's critical for China and for African continent going forward within the framework of G20. With all challenges posed by President Donald Trump of the United States, I think there will be a continued focus on these issues. We might see a selective globalization in which the US and other Western countries might want to continue with the globalization for few rich countries, dictating to the developing and global South countries. While there will be a rise, as we see, with the strength of global South and China playing a constructive role within global South, I think we're going to see much more unity within global South to advance globalization and ensure that it's a globalization that brings win-win, not one-sided globalization. And therefore, I think Premier Li stated this at a very critical moment. Help in the sense of more skills, uptake of scholarships within Chinese universities, and increase the number in critical job skills required to improve the well-being of the continent and expand employability of women in particular. And the youth is training in all these areas, particularly in artificial intelligence and critical areas where Africa has issues such as climate change, issues of disaster management, on issues such as agriculture. I think in these areas, more skills are required to bring more, but more importantly, I think training African youth and women in entrepreneurship, ensure that they create their own jobs. I think it's a key to development and strengthen Africa-China relations.
Now for international news, Russia and Ukraine trade deadly strikes as the U.S. and Moscow hold talks.
Russian attacks on Ukraine's capital, Kyiv, have killed at least six people, according to the city's mayor. And in just some developing news, a U.S. official has confirmed to the BBC that they're now meeting Russian representatives in Abu Dhabi following the Geneva talks between the U.S. and Ukraine about a draft peace plan. Where Russia attacked Kyiv with a wave of missiles and drones, the night sky over the Ukrainian capital was lit up with explosions. Officials say two residential apartment blocks were hit. And the city's mayor said that a central high-rise building was evacuated. Once again, residents of the city made their way down into the metro system to spend the night sheltering from the Russian attack. Well, in Russia, the governor of Rostov region said that Ukrainian drones killed three people and wounded 10 more. Six were hit in Krasnodar. Russian defense officials say that more than 200 Ukrainian drones were destroyed. And the UK Prime Minister, Keir Starmer, is going to speak to Ukraine's European allies later today after Washington and Kyiv said that they've agreed a refined peace framework in talks over the weekend. Well, our Ukraine reporter Abdujalil Abdurasalov is in Kyiv. He says there have been reports from Moscow about the Kremlin spokesperson's initial reaction to the revised plan.
Well, we're now actually getting reports from Moscow that Dmitry Peskov mentioned about this new revised document. Dmitry Peskov, the spokesperson of President Vladimir Putin, he referred to it as substantial. So does that mean that the Russian side may accept the new revised document? We still don't know, but there are some signs that the original document, the 28-point peace plan suggested by the U.S., is now being changed. And Vladimir Zelensky mentioned about this document and said that the new version of this document is doable, as he called it. And he says that the new draft includes fewer points, but it has right elements. That means that the Ukrainian side is far more optimistic, and they may see the new version of this peace plan as something that they can work with and that something that can bring peace in Ukraine. However, the most contentious bits in this peace plan, such as the territory and the NATO membership, has not been directly addressed in the new version, according to President Zelensky. He says that that's the right approach, because these things must be discussed directly between the presidents, between him and Donald Trump.
Abdujalil Abdurasalov there reporting from Kyiv. Let's pick up on some of those points with Orisya Lutsevich, Deputy Director of the Russia and Eurasia Program at Chatham House, and also you're the head of the Ukraine Forum. Let's start with the territories, because that was always a red line for President Zelensky. Did it have to go to that stage about taking over the whole of the Donbass in order to move back and just move to the lines that Russia holds now?
Well, I think it's very important to understand why the principle on the territory is important. It's important for Ukraine, but it's also important for the UN Charter. This is how we build relationship between the sovereign nations, that the borders should not be changed by force. That's why on one hand, Ukraine is insisting that there is no recognition of Russian occupation by United States or by any other democratic nation, and also that Ukraine is not pressured to retreat from its own sovereign territory and give it to the occupation of Russia. Also, especially because we know what kind of atrocities and persecutions are happening on these territories for Ukrainian population and Ukrainian children.
So would the Ukrainian population accept the lines as they are now with the territories that Russia occupies?
What's important to understand, Katya, is that in Ukraine, people are ready for peace. They want peace, but not peace at any price. More than 70% of Ukrainians say yes, they would be happy to freeze the current line of contact, the front line, but the rest of the territory must receive a very strong security guarantees that Russia will not reinvade after this phase of the war. And this is where Ukraine needs United States, and Europe, for the same matter, needs United States in order to make the security arrangement for the rest of Ukraine viable and for it to be a very strong deterrence against the future war.
And arguably the strongest security guarantee is NATO membership. If that is off the table, is that acceptable to Ukrainians?
I think at this point, Ukraine is also making two points. One, that Russia should not dictate whether in the future Ukraine should or should not be a member of NATO. That's a sovereign choice of Ukraine. But Ukraine is also ready to work with its allies, with the United States and with current NATO member nations to set up something special for Ukraine. That is not ideal. That is actually threatening more of these nations who are backing Ukraine, not in a collective way as not NATO is. But this is if this is the reality, Ukraine is ready to work with.
And of course, the European Union were concerned that they had no involvement in this suggested peace plan. Are you concerned about how Donald Trump is pushing this through?
Well, absolutely. What is very concerning is that the plan originally put on the table last week was speaking on behalf of both NATO and European Union and also these Russian sovereign assets that are held in the EU, especially Belgian jurisdiction, without any prior consultation with what everybody in Europe thinks to be an alliance. And this is where I think also a plan of Putin is through this diplomacy around Ukraine is to really wreck this transatlantic alliance, which prevents him from his militaristic expansion in Europe. This is also one of his goals, why he is engaging in this so-called diplomacy.
Orisia Lutsevich from Chatham House, as always, thank you very much. Also from the Ukraine Forum, appreciate your thoughts there. Much more on this ongoing story, developing story, also as we learn that US officials have confirmed to the BBC that they're going to be meeting Russian representatives in Abu Dhabi today. So much more on that. And of course, also the strikes on the ground as well, with six people killed in strikes on Kyiv. So do stay with us because we'll be coming back to this story throughout the day here on the BBC News Channel.
And with that being said, we have now officially come to the conclusion of today's episode of On the Radar News Analysis. Do stay tuned for the Onkona Nadengi program brought to you by Loise Shimi. Don't forget the Home Run Show with Dwight and Helmut from 16:30. Also, the business economic segment comes your way from 1600 hours. Now from Indafa, happy Juju, it is goodbye and have yourself a wonderful 25th November.